Before I give the reading, I want to tell you a story that reflects on what you're hearing. A friend of mine was working for a very high-paced Boston area company, and when he heard they were going to send him to Germany for 3 years, he knew that he was going to have to do well on that in order to get the promotion he wanted. So the first thing he did was to start taking lessons in German. And he took 6 months' worth of lessons in German, went to Germany, and there he had scheduled a German tutor to work with him. And in their first session together, she had him repeating all kinds of things and talking to him a little bit in German. And at the end of it, he said, "So, how did I do?" I should tell you that this gentleman comes from the greater Boston area and has what is normally known as a Boston accent. He says, "Oh, how did I do? How was I? Pretty good, huh?" And his tutor said, "Well, you're obviously very committed, you're an eager learner, you've done pretty well, and I think we can probably do something about that speech defect that you have." "Speech defect," he said. "What speech defect?" "Hey, you don't seem to pronounce your R's." And he said, "Listen, where I come from, we call that a regional accident. Or accent." And she says, "Yes, but in Germany we call it a speech defect." I have a speech defect, which some of you are hearing, is the result 10 years ago of surgery for oral cancer that probably saved my life. So I live with it. It doesn't hurt. I can't even hear it myself. I just know it's there because I hear myself on tape. So please don't worry on my behalf. The reading is written by Robbie Walsh, who was for many, many years the minister of our church in Duxbury. I heard the second Brandenburg Concerto played in honor of Bach's 300th birthday, and I was swept away. I remembered a story about the people who send messages out into space. Someone suggested sending a piece by Bach. The reply was, "But that would be bragging." Some say we get what we deserve in life, but I don't believe it. We certainly don't deserve Bach. What have I done to deserve the second Brandenburg Concerto? I have not been kind enough. I have not done enough justice. I have not loved my neighbor or myself sufficiently. I have not praised God enough to have earned a gift like this. Life is a gift that we have not earned and for which we cannot pay. There is no necessity that there be a universe, no inevitability about a world moving toward life and then self-consciousness. There might have been nothing at all. So since we have not earned Bach or crocuses or lovers, the best we can do is express our gratitude for the undeserved gifts we have been given, and then do our share in the work of creation. That concludes the reading by Robbie Walsh. Most of us grew up expecting that the sheer passage of time would finally land us in the magical world called maturity. Turns out we were wrong. Maturity is not something that time automatically bestows upon us. It is something we may rise to occasionally, but then only in our best moments. More often than not, we take 3 steps forward, toward maturity and two steps back. In our worst days, it is more like two steps forward and three back. Our childhood's old feelings, reactions, and habits pull us backwards sometimes. Our past trips us up. We stumble and fall more often than we care to admit. And it is part of the outrageousness of preaching that I get to talk about this. Because I cannot hold myself out as a paragon of maturity. I get there once in a while, as do most people, and I would like to get there more often. I find things generally go better when I'm being mature, and I feel better about myself. So how do I know? How do we know what it takes to become mature? As a way of approaching what is a very elusive topic, I want to tell you some stories that have led my thoughts in the last couple of weeks. Number one, Sylvia Stalker, who is the minister of the UU Church in Brunswick, Maine, remembers that when the year that she was appointed forelady of a jury, it was a difficult and convoluted case concerning the fate of a man accused of driving while under the influence of alcohol. After the first full day of deliberations, the jury was split down the middle, and everyone went home with the unhappy prospect of spending many more hours, if not days, in the basement of the courthouse. The next morning, as a way of breaking the impasse, Sylvia suggested that each person try arguing the position about this man's guilt or innocence that they had not taken the day before. Perhaps if they could learn to entertain arguments other than their own, they might eventually be able to come to a verdict. Well, everyone thought that might help. God knows they were up for anything that would help. And so they began. As it turned out, no one but Sylvia and one other juror could actually do it. They had spent the entire first day talking at each other. And no one could remember what the people on the other side of the question had said to them. Each juror had been in advocacy mode. They had stopped listening to each other, if they had ever been listening to each other. And she mentioned in the column she wrote about this, she worried, I think correctly, that this is too often the fate of juries and congregations. We grow up in advocate mode. It's important for our development that we are able to speak for ourselves. Words like me and mine and no become extremely important at an early stage of life, which I'm sure that every parent and grandparent here remembers. Because through them, we assert that we have a life independent from our parents. Years later, there is a stage in our lives when we go into high advocate mode. And that is because our own agenda is so powerful to us, we convince ourselves that the people who care about us also must agree with us. My two children sometimes complain that we were not listening to them. We responded that we actually had listened to them, and we then repeated back to them almost exactly what we had heard them say. The problem was we simply didn't agree with them. And at that time in their lives, they couldn't see the difference between hearing them and agreeing with them. Unfortunately, this is a problem for many adults as well. Maturity means realizing that the world is full of opinions that we don't hold. And some of the people who have those opinions that we don't hold are perfectly wonderful people who may be prepared to like us anyway. Moreover, some of those opinions that we don't hold open up whole new avenues to the truth that we couldn't find alone or by ourselves. With that realization, we learn not merely to tolerate differing opinions, but to welcome them. We welcome them because we realize that what we can understand is bounded by our inevitable limitations, and without help from others, we cannot see beyond those limitations. Maturity is helping others, it's allowing others to help us adjust our view of the world. Story number two. Years ago, I read an article by the admissions director of William and Mary College. If you've ever been to Williamsburg, Virginia, Colonial Williamsburg, you know where William and Mary is. It's right off the campus. He told of reading one application that in many respects was little different from the other. The presentation and the formatting of the application were absolutely faultless, as if perhaps typed in the office of the applicant's father, who happened to be a high-priced lawyer. The language and the imagery in the essays was incredibly spectacular, reflecting perhaps more the language and thought and sophistication than an average applicant of 17 or 18 years old would normally have, more like perhaps her mother might have. It was an application like many he had seen, clearly put together, perhaps even written, by the candidate's parents. There was one difference. At the end of the application, where the candidate signed it, she had written in large block letters, "Please do not admit me." And with that, he realized that the candidate was not the person in her family who wanted her to go to William and Mary. They had allowed her to sign and seal the application, and in that moment, she declared herself. I cite this example partly because of an experience I had with our eldest child when I finally learned that my aspirations for him and his aspirations for himself were simply part of two different lives, mine and his. And I now know that, like many parents, I have been trying to micromanage his college search. It's not hard to do, since for a long period of time they seem to be not even aware that college is in the future, maybe. But I have been pushing the process along. And at some point, he really pushed back, lovingly but firmly. And I realized then that no matter how much I loved him, or cared for him, or was prepared to sacrifice for him, he had to be his own person, prepared to take the consequences of his own decisions. And unless that happened, our entire relationship from that point on would be partly a sham for both of us. Maturity means recognizing that good relationships need good boundaries. I may like you, but I will not be everything you want me to be. I have my own assessment of who I am and what I want to become. You may want my help, but I can only give as much as I can give, which may not be as much as you feel you need. And I'll have to live with that. I hope you can too. We may enjoy being together, but we each need our time alone. I cannot save or even fully protect you. You cannot save me. We can disagree, and that will not reflect how much we admire or care for or respect one another. You may be furious about something, and though we care deeply about each other, I don't have to share or echo your fury. I would like for you to be happy, but I can't make you happy. And I know very well that if I try too hard to make you happy, I will end up making both of us unhappy. Maturity means recognizing the boundaries between our lives and other lives, set out limits within which our lives are much healthier. Number three, I had the good fortune to train for ministry at the University of Chicago while Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was interviewing dying patients at Billings Hospital. She was trying to understand the kind of ministry or help that would be of most use to them. And those interviews culminated in her book on death and dying. I was fortunate to be an intern chaplain at the time when she was doing those interviews, and then I was present for some of them, which took place in a small room behind a one-way glass. The patient and Dr. Kubler-Ross and Billings Hospital chaplain Carl Nieswander sat on one side of the glass, and about 40 doctors and nurses and seminarians sat on the other side. And the patient knew we were there but could not see us and was told that we were there so that they, the patient, could teach us how to help people who were seriously ill. One interview stands out for me for reasons that did not go into the book. Our chaplain supervisor was leading the interview, and it became clear early on that he was completely out of sync with the patient. The patient wanted to talk about one thing, and our chaplain marched bravely on in an entirely different direction, missing every verbal cue. The interview went nowhere. The patient left mystified, probably dissatisfied. As was their custom after the interview, Carl and Elizabeth sat down with us to discuss what had happened. Well, in true University of Chicago fashion, the onlookers piled on the criticism, particularly the doctors. How could you have missed it? What were you thinking? Why did you change the subject just when you seemed to be getting somewhere? And our chaplain supervisor responded, "You're right. I blew it. I never picked up the cues." Well, his admission only intensified the criticism, particularly from the medical students, was that how can this man boldly admit to having made a mistake? Surely he ought to mount a better defense. Maturity means recognizing that we can make mistakes. We make mistakes for reasons that have nothing to do with our essential intelligence, with our competence, with our fitness, or our reliability. We make mistakes because all people, and particularly people with responsibilities, do make mistakes. And mistakes are not a stain on our character. Maturity means recognizing that we learn from our mistakes. And among other things we learn, there are mistakes do not define us. And when we get that, we can move on. Story Number four out of five, if you're counting. Story number four is really not so much a story, but it's a reflection. When we first enter a loving and committed relationship with another person, we are carried along for a while by our excitement about just being together with that person. And inevitably, at some point, we will test the relationship by entering into a give and take with the person to whom we have declared our love. And although we may never admit this to ourselves at the time, what we are trying to discover is whose ego is stronger. Who can accumulate more of the marbles, the power in this relationship? And at this point, we are still defined by childhood needs that dominate our lives. And the first 2 or 3 years of a relationship, I see it happening in my own congregation when people I married and then go through these 2 or 3 years. They're usually the toughest because this is the time when testing goes on. Maturity means getting beyond the preoccupation with precisely how much and what's in it for us. Maturity means getting outside of ourselves and our needs long enough to recognize that other people have to have their own needs met. And their desire that at least some of those needs be met is just as intense, just as desperate, just as important as our own desire. And maturity means recognizing that when people are able to reach to each other out of the carefully constructed, well-defended interiority of their separate lives, that relationship, when they actually reach each other, that relationship borders on the sacred. Story number five. A friend and colleague of mine grew up with a family that bickered constantly. I can personally attest to this and say that because I stayed with that family for a few days once, and I know I could not have survived a week of it, let alone half a life with this family. My friend's way of coping with it was to imagine himself as being a member of a family that was kind and loving, secure, peaceful, and serene. And he chose a family that at the time was very well known. Now, this was in the early 50s. And for reasons that may seem incomprehensible to us now, the feeling is family of Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip, Charles and Anne, seemed to him to be the kind of family he would have liked to belong to. And for reasons that now seem highly misguided, this Jewish kid from the Bronx became fascinated with the royal family, and he remained that way throughout his life. But he carried his Anglophilia very lightly. It was a game he played with the anxieties he had about not being good enough. Anxieties that were messages from his childhood. But though it was a game, he played it thoroughly by joining the English-speaking union in every town where he served, by becoming the president of each local chapter. He dined with lords and ambassadors. He even taught his 2 young sons to troop the colors to a recording of British martial music, and they did it faultlessly. This friend of mine also began to eat when his anxieties built up. I always knew this was happening because I used to always get his newsletter, and I found that when it started happening, he would start a gourmet explorers club in whatever church he was serving. And then when his waistline became unacceptably broad, he would found a UU Weight Watchers group or encourage his parishioners to go jogging with him regularly. The idea was to make a game out of wherever his anxieties led him. And if his anxieties about how he was doing in the parish, if his parishioners were going to lead him to gaining too much weight, he was going to take them with him. Now, I'm not trained in therapy, but I understand that a neurosis is the way in which we individually respond to anxiousness and fear. Many of us have neuroses, and sometimes they threaten to take over and control our lives. A neurotic is a person who suffers from a neurosis of fear and anxiety that impedes his or her enjoyment of life. My friend treated each neurosis as if it were an eccentric guest. He treated the guest with kindness and with playful humor, but he did not allow it to run the household. Maturity means that we are reasonably in charge of our neuroses. They can amuse us, but we do not allow them to run the household. When my friend knew he was dying, he asked me to conduct his memorial service, and he made one specific request. He chose the last hymn, and he asked me not to tell anyone what it would be until we actually sung it. At his suggestion, we did not distribute copies of it until the end of the service. And then I said something like, "And now we will pass out the final hymn." The hymn started to roll across the congregation, and as it moved from one end to the other, a giggle formed and rolled behind it like a following wave, as finally we stood and sang, "God Save the Queen." What does maturity mean? Maturity means that we are not afraid of differences and can even allow ourselves to be taught by them. Maturity means that we know where our own boundaries are and we respect the boundaries of others. It means that we do not hesitate to own our own fallibility, and it means that we cherish our closest relationships because we know how much is being given to us through them. Finally, maturity means that we can know our demons, we can know our demons and laugh at them. And in so doing, we stay in charge of the household of our lives. Amen.